Hello, Silver City and Grant County. You are listening to Earth Matters on your Gila Membrus Community Radio Station, KURU, 89.1 FM. My name is Nathan Newcomer, and I'm the Gila Grassroots Organizer for the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, and I'm your host for today's show. The New Mexico Wilderness Alliance is a nonprofit organization dedicated to the protection, restoration, and continued enjoyment of New Mexico's wildlands and wilderness areas. On today's program, we are broadcasting a keynote address by author and environmental activist Terry Tempest Williams, who recently spoke at the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act Conference in Albuquerque this past October. The Wilderness Conference in Albuquerque drew over 2,000 people from across the country and offered a myriad of talks, presentations, and discussions about the past, present, and future of wilderness preservation in America. We here at Earth Matters are working to bring you more of these keynote talks from the Wilderness Conference, which include Dave Foreman, Senator Tom Udall, and Senator Martin Heinrich. Today's broadcast of Terry Tempest Williams is a very moving speech about our sense of place in the wilderness movement and how, as a community, we must stay vigilant in the fight to preserve the wildest places left in the United States. Terry is introduced by my good friend and colleague, Nathan Small, who works for the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance and is also a city councilor in Las Cruces. So without further ado, here is Terry Tempest Williams.
I get the extreme pleasure to now introduce what I think, judging by the number of hugs she got just in a very short time, one of collectively our favorite people of all times, and rightfully so, Terry Tempest Williams. She can't come up yet. Yeah. I was immersed in reading Ed Abbey when I first met Terry there at the College of Worcester. I won't go too deeply into the story. I know that she might have a little bit planned there. But suffice to say, my hair was longer. I still had a truck, although a different one. And by fortune that smiled on us, we made it back in time for her talk that night after meeting briefly that morning. We'll leave the rest for Terry. We've been friends ever since. I think we each feel, and if you've ever read really a single page of Terry's writing, you feel this intense, incredible connection to her. Of course, she's written 7 books, 3 different poetry collections, 4 essay collections, and she writes regular columns for The Progressive and for Orion. She shares her place, sometimes in aching and courageous detail. And in so doing, she always helps us find our individual place, and perhaps equally important, our collective place. She writes lovingly of place, with rage for those who would wantonly destroy it. And she simply translates our wonderful, terrible, beautiful, complicated world. We know we could go on and on with superlatives, but much easier to simply say, Terry, we're so excited to have you here today, and ask Terry Tempest Williams to join me here up on stage for her part of this keynote address. Please welcome Terry.
Thank you, Nathan. I love Nathan. And first of all, let me just look at you. This is a gathering of family. Nathan and I met in 2004, as he said, at Worcester College. I had been warned by the provost that there was a rather questionable young man who was rather obsessive. I didn't have to talk to him, and that there was some man he wanted me to talk to him about, or that he wanted to talk about, named, I think it was Edward Abbey, and you don't have to deal with him. We can absolutely sweep away. And I said, where is he? I want to see him immediately. And he was hiding behind a bush. Do you remember? And I just thought, he's my brother. And what we ended up doing was going in his truck, and we found this beautiful swamp that he took me to, and we We spent the entire day looking at snapping turtles and talking about New Mexico and Utah and wilderness and Abby, and I barely made it back in time. On that day, I saw a passionate leader, not just of the future, but of the present. And I think that, Nathan, I really honor you and your role in wilderness protection, your leadership and your guts, for running for political office, for being a public servant, and still a fierce wilderness advocate. And I don't know, how about a write-in campaign for this governor election? It is a meeting of the Coyote Clan, individuals who discreetly tuck their tails inside their pants or beneath their skirts. They can laugh louder and cry harder than anyone on the planet. You know them well. They are sitting next to you, and you recognize yourself every morning when you brush your teeth. This gathering of the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act does feel like family. Our chosen family, in all its wildness, unruliness, and grace. And I want to dedicate this next few minutes, I've been given 40 minutes, it may go less, to Lenny Colm. And Lenny was one of the great wilderness advocates in the Arctic, in the American West, and he returned home to Appalachia, where he really spent the last several years working with Appalachia Rising and mountaintop removal. He never forgot the people, and he never forgot the wild, and he was as humble hero as I have ever known. The full spectrum is here today, and I can't believe the depth of our histories. We really could go around this entire room. And I want you personally to know, and I know Brooke shares this with me, how much we love you, appreciate you, and honor the work that you do on the ground, in your own chosen place, where you take your love and put it into action. I especially am grateful for Tish Braska, for all your care, for Vicki Hoover, for your activism, the incomparable Dave Foreman, who invited me to be part of this conference, and how could you ever say no to Dave Foreman? You are and will be forever our preacher, giving us sermons about the wild, and today was no different. Standing room only. This afternoon's homily was a story about almost being stomped to death by a bull musk oxen in the Arctic and what a good death might look like. In wilderness, where the goal is not to be protected, but present. So many dear friends here, too many to mention, but I am going to mention two, and they are formidable. Howie Wolk and Bart Kohler, who drove me back to Jackson Hole, Wyoming. I was 22 years old. I was still an active Mormon. And Marty Murray, it was in 1977 at the Alaska Lands hearing in Denver. I was wanting to go back to Jackson. She didn't have room in her car, and she said, "Let me find you a ride." And there I found myself in the back seat of a pretty beat up VW with Bart Kohler and Howie Wolk driving. The floor was completely gone. I had my feet up close to my chest, watching the road go by. And there we ended up on a myriad of roads, to their great dismay, in the Red Desert, figuring out what had wilderness quality. That day changed my life, and I realized I wanted to be part of that kind of firebrand joy. It was Marty Murray who spoke to us that day on Wild Alaska and said, "Gentlemen, I come to you today and speak as an emotional woman. And gentlemen, what's wrong with emotion?" I've never forgotten that. She brought the house down. The same way I saw Edward Abbey bring the house down at East High School in 1987 in Salt Lake City, where I asked my father for one favor. And he said, "What is it?" And I said, "I can't tell you. You just have to say, will you do it?" And he said, "You're my daughter. What can I say?" And I said, will you come with me to go hear Ed Abbey? And he said, this is a man whose pipeline construction company had seen its own fair share of sugared gas tanks. Monkey wrenching wasn't a fiction for my father. It was a reality. He said, why would you make me go see this man who's my enemy? And I said, so you can understand me. My father came because I was his daughter. Let's say he was curious. After Abby's long, rambling talk of river trips, slow elk, and immigration policy, someone in the audience asked Ed what was next for him. Voter turnout's a bit low in Arizona, he said. I think I'm going to run for governor. After the evening was over, my father stood up from his chair and walked directly up to Ed, and I was terrified. And then I saw him shake his hand. And then I saw him pull out his wallet, and he said, let me be the first to contribute to your campaign. Why, how, what turned my father in an opposite direction? Passion, wilderness, integrity. He recognized those qualities in himself. My father secretly loved wilderness too. He not only saw Abby's conviction, but he felt it. Ed was a man of imagination and action. My father was inspired. It is not enough to love the world. You must dive in. When I was very young, I used to go out at night and howl at the moon just for practice, just for kicks, and just in case it came to that, look around. The moonlight taught me everything conspires to love. That's a poem by Charles Finn. This is what I want to talk about for the next half hour or so. Love. We are here because of love. A love that is wild. Our love for the wild. Wilderness, wildness, with or without us.
You are listening to Earth Matters on KURU 89.1 FM. We'll be right back with Terry Tippis Williams after a quick break. Welcome back to Earth Matters on KURU 89.1 FM. My name is Nathan Newcomer, and I work with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, and I'm your host for today's show. We'll get you right back into the action with Terry Tempus Williams right now.
To be part of community, as Aldo Leopold taught us, that includes rocks, rivers, plants, animals, not just human beings. We see ourselves, as Harvey Locke says, one species among many. This is our passion. This is our life's work. This is the continuum. Conservation is a generational stance. When I met Marty in 1974, I was 18 years old. I was a student at the Teton Science School, being mentored by Ted and Joan Major in Kelly, Wyoming. I saw Marty's slideshow on the Sheenjek, and I listened to her stories of quote-unquote spirited people. That's what she always said Olas called us. I saw the likes of Olas and Abe Murray, Wheezy Murray, and George Schaller, who as a graduate student asked Olas what he should do when they went to the Sheenjik. And Olas said, wear out your boots. And he did. I heard names like Celia Hunter, Ginny Wood, William Douglas, Rachel Carson, Stuart Udall, Nancy Newell, Brock Evans, and the Wayburns. They were biologists, activists, politicians, judges, writers, and artists, and I wanted to be like them. I wanted to care about wilderness as much as they did. I was from Utah, and I believed from my Mormon upbringing that when Brigham Young said, this is the place, it included Red Rock Wilderness, even the Red Rock walls rising upward like praying hands. It was a spiritual thing for me. And it was Marty who allowed me to believe at a young age that I had a voice in the wilderness and I had an obligation to use it. Looking back over 50 years, we have much to thank our elders for within the traditional wilderness movement. This Wilderness Act is chief among them. This is our past. We are thinking about our future. Let's talk about the present. I'm hearing powerful voices speaking on behalf of wilderness, and they are indigenous people like Sarah James and Princess Lukai of the Gwich'in Nation, who are calling for the protection of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge because it's their home. And they are the Fort Beck, Assiniboine, and Sioux tribes. That when the bison crossed the line at Yellowstone National Park, it was the tribes that said, "We will bring them back home." It's William Mack Jr. here with us tonight, field manager of Black Rock in Nevada at the Winnemucca District Office, where he oversees 7 wilderness areas and 3 WSAs and the largest NCA on public lands in America, where the largest Leave No Trace public event known as Burning Man takes place. William grew up in Alabama, where in his words, he grew trees fast and cut them fast. And he ended up working with the BLM. This morning he said to me, the environmental movement is a continuation of the civil rights movement, which is a movement of justice. And he has never forgotten that. He works for the Bureau of Land Management, and I am so proud to know him. The wilderness movement is growing, and it is growing beyond our traditional history with a broader base and a broader vision. This does not mean a compromise of wilderness. This means a vision of wilderness that is being shared with more people, by more people, with a different kind of vocabulary from a different point of reference. I've asked Erin Halcom to share her perspective tonight, yielding my time to her. She's a former employee of the Forest Service, where she not only fought fires, but served as a fire lookout at Dutchman in the Rogue River National Forest in Oregon. She's a biologist by training and received her master's degree in the Environmental Humanities Program at the University of Utah. And she's now program coordinator at the Taft Nicholson Environmental Humanities Center in Centennial Valley in Montana. But most importantly, she's a lover of wilderness and words. Literature has always been one of our lifelines within the conservation community. Erin's words are a lifeline for me now. And I want you to hear her.
She'll be back. Okay. Good evening. It's a terrifying thrill to be here. To be amongst this tribe, our nation's wilderness advocates. I thank you, Terry and Nathan, for the opportunity. And I thank all of you, my kindred colonels on the corn cob, for the work that you do, sincerely. Over this past week, I've been asking myself, what can I offer to a room of environmentalists? My story? Let's begin at 21, my senior year of college, when I called my mother to complain that I'd be spending my birthday studying for a final exam. She responded offhandedly, "Well, at least you're not getting shipped to Saigon." And I heard her for the first time in a long while. So after graduation, I enrolled in a national service program called AmeriCorps. I moved from Georgia to Oregon and banded tightly with a crew of folks that had come from all across the country to perform, like me, 1 year of environmental restoration. Our projects were diverse. We fought forest fires and restored fish habitat. We served across a wide variety of public land ownerships and designations, packing in crosscut saws and camping out for weeks to clear trails in the wilderness. I gained knowledge and skill and confidence. I signed up for another term, and I became increasingly more feral. In fact, when I returned home, my mother, having served as a nurse in Vietnam, saw the areas on my back and arms where the pigment was discolored and identified it as a fungus. She said soldiers would get it from wearing their soiled uniforms for too long. She asked me just how often was I showering and laundering my work shirts. This was a Georgia girl who cried in grade school because her clothes weren't good enough and who was ticketed in college for littering. My lesson, never underestimate the power to transform, to transcend. My invitation to you, go feral. Presently, I'm employed on a research team that questions how forest thinning to reduce the risk and intensity of wildfire affects small mammals. And I spend the day hiking in the hills of southern Oregon and checking hundreds of mini wire mesh cages for critters. Most often, when I peer behind the door of a trap, I am greeted or scolded, I can never tell which, with the chatter of a chipmunk. Sometimes when I look in, I see, curled back in the nest box, a soft glint off the quiet eye of a flying squirrel. I ear tag what I find, and then I turn the animal over in my palm. If it's a female, I blow across her belly in order to part the fur and determine if she has yet nursed young. Ultimately, I handle these animals because they are deemed valuable as prey. Flying squirrels and bushy-tailed wood rats, in particular, are considered critical meals for the region's threatened Pacific fisher and spotted owl. But they've given me much fodder, too. I wonder how my values would differ if I had stayed in Atlanta. What would be my desires, my metaphors? These days, I desire the durability and pluck of a chipmunk, who, after being barrel-rolled in the middle of the night, stands up inside its cage and cheeps at me, which is without a doubt the sound of protest. I seek the stealth magic of a flyer to glide with elegance through the dark. And when I glance around my room at any time, I am reminded of what a scientist once cataloged inside a pack rat's stick nest. Feathers, socks, a bar of soap, a bottle, and a jelly roll. I see my own compulsion to covet, carry off, and accumulate. And so I pray for restraint, to stop myself from taking and doing just because I can. For imagination, to redefine what exacts pleasure and valor. And I try each day to redignify myself by recalculating my own capacity for generosity. Last year, the dysfunction in our political system led to the closing of our national parks and refuges. And I thought, what if we had elected to give our lands a rest day, a week or two? What if we didn't divide our watersheds into hiking and biking days, but offered wildlife quietude during breeding season? What a lovely gesture. To date, I think the greatest gesture Americans have made is the preservation of wilderness. We limit our work and play in acknowledgement of our collective disturbance. We've set up a trust fund for the future. Gary Snyder wrote, "Grasses photosynthesizing are the ultimate working class." What a humbling thought. Before you leave here, I ask that you close your eyes. Forget the labels, the inches and pounds and years that define you, and think only of the future. Feel how much you want. I feel at times that I could burn right through my skin. I want so much, and I believe that this is our commonality and our strength. I believe that now, as always, there is a great hunger within people to understand the wit of their universe, and that through service and story, we can cultivate conservationists from all generations. I believe that elder is a title that must be earned, that our movement isn't a job that you can retire from. And so I ask of you to stay with me in this, because the sentiments behind wilderness, generosity and respect and reverence, don't diminish with age or how much you give. Trust me. Love does not have a net zero sum. Thank you.
This is what the present looks like. This is what the future looks like. I'd like to see how many individuals here are in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. Would you stand? And you will stand for us at the 100th anniversary. And is there anyone here that was present in 1964? Yeah. So. And this is what stamina looks like.
You are listening to Earth Matters on KURU 89.1 FM, and we'll be right back with Terry Tempest Williams after a quick break. Welcome back to Earth Matters on KURU 89.1 FM. My name is Nathan Newcomer, and I'm your host for today's show. We've been listening to Terry Tempest Williams on Earth Matters, KURU 89.1 FM, and we'll get you right back to the action right now.
Half Earth is the goal, says E.L. Wilson. People haven't been thinking big enough, he says, especially conservationists. I see a chain of uninterrupted corridors forming with twists and turns, some of them opening up to become wide enough to accommodate national biodiversity parks, a new kind of park that won't let species vanish. I also am thinking about such wildland chains as long landscapes, Wilson continues in his latest article that appeared in last month's Smithsonian Magazine. It sounds a lot like the Wildlands Project, doesn't it? I like the idea, he says, that they could meet climate change head on. It's what biologist Michael Soule has been saying for years, the father of conservation biology, a discipline he defined as mission-oriented, interdisciplinary, interrelated with other disciplines, because our survival is at stake. He wrote in an emotional call to arms, quote, "Perhaps the hardest thing to grasp is the geological and historical uniqueness of the next few decades. There is simply no precedent for what is happening to the biological fabric of this planet, and there are no words to express the horror of those who love nature. But loss of habitat and loss of species is not the whole disaster," Soule says. "Perhaps even more shocking than the unprecedented wave of extinction is the cessation of significant evolution of new species of large plants and animals. Death is one thing, an end to birth is something else, and nature reserves are too small to gestate new species." End of quote. As humans, we evolved in wilderness and we will continue to evolve with wilderness. That's why our public lands have never been more precious and never been more relevant. We cannot give in. Not when the salmon are still swimming upstream. Not when the yellow-billed loon is seen solitary in gates of the Arctic wilderness. Not when the wolverine knows that its place is in the Northern Rockies, even if the politicians don't. Not the willow flycatcher who is surviving drought along the Colorado River. We cannot give in. Wilderness is a place where all elements are working in concert as a natural system with one goal, passing life on to the future. Evolution is about adapting to changing conditions, but climate changes are occurring faster than we can biologically evolve or adapt. Because we humans have so quickly modified the planet's ability To support life, we must call on a different evolutionary adaptation, something conscious and deliberate, diverging away from anything yet we've been able to perceive. What if wildness is the highest form of imagination? Imagination leads to creative acts. I want to tell you a story about a German composer named Max Richter. His favorite piece of music is Vivaldi's Four Seasons. We're all familiar with it. He had played it as a musician hundreds of times and had heard it more than he had performed it. And as a musician, the strangest thing happened. This favorite piece of music became he couldn't hear it anymore. It had become so commercialized, so trivialized, played in elevators in the backdrop to cheap commercials, that he could no longer hear its beauty. It had become lost to him, demoted to musical wallpaper. So Max Richter did the unthinkable, the blasphemous. He reimagined Vivaldi's masterpiece and recomposed it so that he could hear it once again at this moment in time. "I wanted to reclaim this piece," he said. "I wanted to fall back in love with it all over again." He said by getting inside it and rediscovering it for himself, he was able to take a new path through a well-known landscape. Let us hear Max Richter's reimagined Four Seasons. 3 minutes. Can we recompose ourselves? Can we reimagine a different way of being in the world, still holding on to the essentials of what we love and what we will fight for? Land health, wildness, and a livable future. Our institutions and agencies are no longer serving us. Across the board, our governments, our educational systems, our religious institutions. The conservation community is no different. We have never been here before. Brighton Breitenbach, the South African poet, said to me years and years ago, and I've never forgotten it, "You Americans have mastered the art of living with the unacceptable." It is time to reimagine the wilderness movement as a movement of direct action. Each in our own way, each in our own time, with the gifts that are ours. For some, it may be civil disobedience. For some, it may be arrest, as it was for Tim DeChristopher. For some, it may be protesting as an employer in one of our federal agencies. For some, it may be staying. For some, it may be strengthening our core values. Only we can decide. We have never been here before. If you would have told me that going out to Dead Horse Point would become a site of oil and gas flares and a cluster of roads that appear on desert lands like an exposed nervous system, if you would have told me that America's first tar sands development will be in Utah's Book Cliffs at the heart of some of the wildest country in North America waiting for wilderness designation, if you would have told me that sagebrush in our beloved American West would become endangered, threatened alongside sage grouse, pronghorn, and prairie dogs, even mule deer, I would not have believed you. But this is what I know to be true. It is time to lay our bodies down. Now, physically, metaphorically, may we make vows today, tonight, to one another about what that will look like. Sarah James told us today how Gwich'in are caribou people. She said it is our song, our dance, our story, our food, our tools, our clothing, shelter. It means everything to us, she said. And I thought, we are wilderness people. How serious are we? Can we go deeper? Can we be braver? Can we take more risks? We are just beginning to understand what it means to live in a storied landscape. Here, now, present with our hearts wide open, we are stripped bare. We have no choice but to stand our ground in the places we love, knowing in our bones, knowing in our veins, wild lands, wild lives are the beating heart of the open space of democracy. I do not believe we can look for leadership beyond ourselves. I do not believe we can wait for someone or something to save us from our global predicaments and obligations. I need to look in the mirror and ask this of myself: if I'm committed to seeing the direction of our country change, how must I change myself? We are in need of a reflective activism born out of humility, not arrogance. Reflection with deep time spent in the consideration of others opens the door to becoming a compassionate participant in the world. It is time to stage a public lands revolution, evolution from the ground up. We can do this. Right here, right now, with those of us in the room, we can do this. It is time to ignite the federal agencies with our passion, with our love when possible, and our outrage when necessary. From the Forest Service to the Park Service to the National Fish and Wildlife Service to the BLM, let them fear us for what we insist and resist. Susan Sontag says, "The likelihood that our acts of resistance cannot stop the injustice does not exempt us from acting in what we sincerely and reflectively hold to be in the best interest of our communities." While we're at it, we might as well terrorize the Department of Homeland Security. Well, we're already known as eco-terrorists, so why not bear it out? Because life as we know it, our home ground as we understand it, is under siege. Call it the failure of our imagination, call it the corruption of consumption where we've made a god out of capitalism, call it the wholesale ecocide of our planet. How serious are we on the 50th anniversary of this beloved sacred act? The most powerful individual in the American West right now is the sage grouse. Why? Because it's the only living being that threatens to curb the grotesque hunger and thirst of the oil and gas industry's assault on our land, on our water, at the expense of our communities. A bird, stands between greed and grace. Wilderness watch. We have our models. This is our time. Here, now, together, gatekeepers of the wild, part of this revolution must be connecting the dots. We can no longer be a movement that exists in isolation. The wilderness cannot be an island of ecological isolations. They must become communities and corridors of ecological health and wealth.
You are listening to Earth Matters on KURU 89.1 FM, and we'll be right back with Terry Tempest Williams after a short break. Welcome back to Earth Matters on KURU 89.1 FM. My name is Nathan Newcomer with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, and I'm your host for today's show. We're going to finish up with the last piece of Terry Tempest Williams' speech.
400,000 people gathered in New York City and around the world. And if you'll bear with me, just 5 more minutes. I want to share with you what happened. They just kept coming in waves. In torrents, a river of people convening on the streets of New York City in the March for Climate Justice. They just kept coming, hundreds of thousands of individuals, indigenous, black, white, brown, yellow, and red, a rainbow of colors winding through the canyons of Manhattan. This movement of climate justice is no longer segregated. It's no longer privileged. It's no longer young or old or the radical fringe moving toward the center. Instead, this movement resides in the core of a collective concern. Earth has a fever. There is no planet B. What we witnessed on Sunday, September 21st, was 400,000 individuals standing in the center of this crisis with love. At 1 o'clock, the river of the People's March became quiet, silent in a haunting moment of stillness. And then a rolling cry of care rose from the street with undulating momentum like an animated heat wave blown by the wind that electrified the crowd like thunder, like lightning, followed by a rain of voices. The written language of hand-painted signs created its own poetry. Save the earth. Heal the spirit. I can't swim. Let our voices rise, not the sea. I can't swim. Divest from fossil fuels. If the Rockefellers can do it, so can we. I'm building a community that runs without fossil fuels. No more oil, no more coal. Keep our future in the soil. It's raining, it's pouring. We are all Noah's now. Wall Street corporations are junkies. Renewables bring peace. People and the planet over profit. Please love your mother. We have to make peace with nature. Care now, you might be coming back. Quilters for the planet, chefs for climate change, howling for the future, Earth first, Abby was right. Frack off, hey Obama, don't need no fracking drama. Protect me, I cannot swim. Hi, I'm a friendly, sociable scientist, come talk to me. clean water is a right, not just for the rich and white. I am water, I am earth, I am fire, I am air. We are engaged in a crisis of breath. We can overcome. Our planet has a fever. We know who is responsible. Look out the window, UN. The debate is over. The facts are in. The evidence is clear. The next flood will be biblical. Stop the fossil fuel octopus. Stop the tentacles of tar sands and oil shell. Apathy kills our planet, our patience, our future. Interfaith power and light. Why not? What's next? The future of all life depends on our mindful steps. We, the people, walk with the river. This is what love looks like. Activists are flooding Wall Street. The present is now locking hands with the future. We can thank the organizers for mapping the territory of our engagement. And that next night, inside the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, with a great phoenix rising above the congregation, the Reverend Serene Jones said, quote, "We have a soul-size work before us," unquote. Something has been set in motion. With throbbing feet, we are river walking. That night, one of the most powerful things for me was listening to one of the elders from Greenland. They called him Uncle. And he said simply this, that his grandmother told him there was only one thing he had to do as a human being, and that was to melt the ice in each man's heart. And that if he could do that, then that person could feel the heart beating of the earth, and all would be taken care of. The voice of emotional urgency is vital. Our cause is the cause of life, and it is coming to be understood in new and unexpected ways. 3 more minutes. We have a son from Rwanda, and we have come to know their family now as our own. And there's a young man, Louis's brother, named Faustin, who has just now entered college. And I just received this text from him on Thursday. "Dearest Mum, before the short experience that I'm about to share with you, I had not yet understood the importance of the environment. Being honest, one day I asked myself, as a kid in Rwanda, why you talk about the environment so much. Then one Friday, I got an answer. There is a tree where I used to sit, and I would revise my life and play my guitar. I used to love it so much. Then as I was there on Friday, the following day, I went there, and the tree was nowhere to be seen. I was almost crying. I had forgotten I had tears since the war. Since then, I came to understand the importance of protecting the environment." Wilderness is not an abstraction or an idea or a recreation. It is our sanity. It is our survival. And our survival is rooted in relationships. Wilderness in the 21st century is not a site of nostalgia for what once was, but rather it is the seedbed of creativity for what we have yet to imagine. Let us be clear. Let us be bold. Let us be unapologetic, passionate, and fierce. Let us lay our bodies down as a gesture of love. This morning, Chris Barnes asked if we heard the chimes at midnight, and he brought us a bowl. The bowl broke. It shattered. And someone in the audience said, "That's an omen." And Chris was shaken. I think it was an alchemical moment. An omen. We are broken. Our wildlands are broken. We must bear witness to the beauty that remains and reimagine our place on the planet. In the name of wild mercy, we can do this. We must do this. How serious are we? The eyes of the future are looking back at us, and they are praying that we might see beyond our own time. They are kneeling with hands clasped, that we might act with restraint, that we might leave room for the life that is destined to come. To protect what is wild is to protect what is gentle. Perhaps the wildness we fear is the pause between our own heartbeats, the silent space that says we live only by grace. Wilderness lives by this same grace. Wild mercy is in our hands. Direct action is our prayer. We can do this. Thank you.
Thank you all so much for listening to Earth Matters on KURU 89.1 FM. That was a great talk by Terry Tempest Williams. Many thanks to Kyle Johnson, our technical engineer and all-around radio guru. And many thanks to all of our listeners for your community support and dedication. This is what community radio sounds like and looks like. Have a great day, everyone.